Il-program li ser tisimaw u għamiġjub li l-kombixu għatajba ta' Farsons Foundation.
Welcome to University Matters on Campus FM. I'm Patricia Camilleri. In this series, I will be talking to academic staff about their research, their international networks, their aims and plans for the future. I shall also be hearing from staff and students about the many events that take place here at the University of Malta. This is the program that keeps you informed about what's happening on campus. I'm very happy to have with me in the studio today Dr. Nicholas Vella. He's here to talk about a book which he has recently edited together with a colleague. It has been recently launched, and it's about Burj in Nadul, a prehistoric site here in Malta. The book is called Site Artifacts and Landscape, Prehistoric Burj in Nadul, Malta. And as I say, edited by Davide Tanasi from Arcadia University, US, and the College of Global Studies in Italy. And by Dr. Nicholas Vella, Senior Lecturer here, the Head of Department of Classics and Archaeology here at the University. The book is published by Polymetrica, International Scientific Publisher, in a series entitled Prehistorica Mediterranea. And the hard copy includes a very interesting DVD, which I hope we'll talk about at the end of our chat. Welcome to the programme, Dr. Vella. The launch was at the National Museum of Archaeology recently, and there was a presentation by Professor Anthony Bonanno. There were a lot of people very interested in your book. Were you surprised to see such a crowd?
Yes, I think I was. The site is not very well known, but I think just because it was not well known, perhaps it did attract a fair amount of people, mostly members of the Malta Archaeological Society and colleagues from the university and some students as well.
Because it is a specialised book. However, specialised in one way, but not in another, because it does give, as we shall see, it does give the wider picture. But first of all, a few basic questions about the site, where it is, for those listeners who might not be familiar with the actual location of Burj in Nadul.
Yes, Burj in Nadul is located in southeast Malta, in an area which is very close to St. George's Bay. As listeners probably know, Marsaxlokk Harbour is divided into a number of small bays, and the area close to Birzabuja is split into two, the Spriti Bay and St. George's Bay. So driving down to Birzabuja from Zeytun, on the right-hand side, there is a small car park next to a small chapel, which is a chapel dedicated to St. George, and behind that, really through a narrow country lane, there is a site. Well, there are actually a number of sites located in an area which we call Burj in Nadul.
But it's a toponym for the area.
Yes, it is a toponym for the area. Burj in Maltese means a heap, and Nadul is a place where you actually look out from. And the name suggests that this is a place which enjoys good views of the surrounding terrain.
Which it does, especially
of most of Marsaxlokk Harbour.
And the book itself, as you say, an interesting, not much has been researched about Burj in Nadul, I mean, in this kind of way. What was the genesis of the book itself?
Yes, the genesis of the book is quite interesting because, really and truly, I met my my co-editor, Davide Tanasi, when we were both involved in an EU-funded Interreg project, which involved partners from southeast Sicily and partners from Malta. The project was led by the Department of Classics and Archaeology here at the University and by the University of Catania, respectively by Professors Bonanno and Militello. And the idea of that project was for scholars on either side of the channel to get to know the archaeology of the respective areas. And we have known for a long time that there is a lot of common common elements in material culture terms between the two islands, in particular Southeast Sicily and the Maltese Islands. And during this project ran between 2004 and 2006, and during this project I met Davide Tanasi, and I could see that he was young, energetic. He was doing a lot of work as part of the project in Malta, looking at Bronze Age material held at the National Museum of Archaeology, and looking at what might be Maltese pottery imports in museums in Southeast Sicily. As a result of that project, we kept in touch and worked on another publication together. And in August 2010, Davide was in Malta, and he said, "I have just been awarded a substantial grant from the Leon Levy Shelby White Foundation to aid the publication of archaeological reports." This foundation is based at the University of Harvard, and Davide's intention was to do something about the Maltese Bronze Age, in particular the type site of our Maltese, of the Maltese Bronze Age, which is Borsin Nadur. And he said it would be interesting not just to publish the pottery, which he had been studying in the stores, but to provide a proper, comprehensive context for the pottery. And in August 2010, we were having a coffee at Cordina's, and we jotted down a possible contents page of a monograph. The only hitch here was that the book had to be out in a year. So from August 2010 to August 2011.
Wow.
And usually I do not take up such, you know, it was in a sense
a crazy plan.
It was a crazy plan. And what we did was, after a day or two, we met our colleagues at Heritage Malta, because most of the material is held in storage at Heritage Malta, the National Museum of Archaeology, and we spoke to a number of curators and other workers there, co-workers, and we decided to provide a comprehensive account by roping in other other young scholars in this exercise. And therefore the book is really, the attempt was to have a comprehensive account of the site of Borsin Nadur, which is really and truly a much wider area, because Borsin Nadur includes not only a prehistoric temple site, so therefore just like we have at Tarshin, at Hajar Iman Nimnaidra, but also the remains of a Bronze Age fortified village, and also the remains of a Roman villa at Takachatura. And all this is happening in really a small area, I would say almost about a square kilometer. And of course, this is very interesting that all this activity is happening in this one spare of rock. Borsin Nadur has two deep valleys within, on either side. There's the Widdalam, and of course it's called Widdalam because of the cave nearby, which is famous and important in its own right. And on the other side there is Widzemba. And in between these two deep valleys there is this rocky spur, Borsin Nadur, which overlooks St. George's Bay.
So it's an example of collaboration, really good academic collaboration, and has produced a book of breadth, as you say, because you're looking at the various manifestations of Borsin Nadur over the centuries. In your introduction, you go over what the book is all about, and the aims and the scope, the breadth of the book as well. One of the things I liked very, very much, because I'm really into communicating, how you can best communicate archaeology, you have a lovely graphic in there which describes the timeline, exactly sort of the, not only putting Borsin Nadur in a local time context, but looking at what was happening in various areas of the Mediterranean at the same time.
Yeah, very true. Archaeologists, I think, have always realized, but in the last probably decades more than ever before, that the archaeology of an island or of a group of islands depends on looking at the connectivity or otherwise with other places. Malta is not an asteroid, it's not separated by enormous voids, but it is a certain hours of or certain number of days of sailing away from nearest places, and therefore paying a lot of attention to the context, geographical and temporal, in other words, what connections the Maltese islands would have had in time with the nearest neighbor, but also further away, we thought was crucial. For us, it's almost an obvious choice, a sine qua non of writing about Malta. But I think the fact that we had Sicilian and Maltese scholars working together, this was constantly kept in our mind. And we realized that the readership was not going to be Maltese, but hopefully also a foreign one. And therefore, you really cannot take anything for granted. And perhaps because both of us teach at undergraduate, both of us, meaning the editors, teach at undergraduate level, we always keep undergraduates in mind. In other words, that certain givens should be really explained, not taken for granted, and therefore a map with the location of the Maltese islands, especially for an American readership, which the Americans, after all, funded most of this project, could not be taken for granted, but had to be explained. And I think the timeline really helps to show how the prehistory of the Maltese islands is tied into that of its neighbors. Now, there were moments when the connections existed, there were moments when the connections did not exist, but that might have been because of a conscious choice rather than because there was no way of leaving the island and making it to Sicily or vice versa.
And the other thing that really impressed me in this first part of the book is the list of figures, the list of the illustrations. I mean, it really goes on and on and on. And that is quite impressive. It's a lovely thing to find in an academic book like this. And I could see, even looking at the quality of the pictures, that a lot of work had gone into them, that they weren't just photographs or just, you know, boring graphs or whatever. They were really well thought out.
Again, perhaps it's because at heart we are teachers, and in order to communicate a message to students, especially in this day and age, the visual is important. And after all, in our case, the visual of a piece of pottery, which in most cases has never been published, it was important to provide a drawing as a visual record of what was discovered during a century of archaeological work at Borchin Nadur. So we thought that this was essential. You need to show what you are talking about. And in terms of for material culture, this meant either drawing or a photograph, or else both. I think the line drawings are extremely good. I am very happy with the line drawings. Most of them were done by Sicilian colleagues who did a splendid job on the material from the site, for example, of Cozza del Pantano in Sicily. And most of the Maltese material was drawn by one of our former students, Maxine Anastasi. She did a splendid job. And I remember her going to the museum and drawing, you know, shade after shade after shade in pencil, and then finishing that on computer, so that the quality would be perfect for publication. Admittedly, some of the photographs did not reproduce well enough in the book, but the accompanying the DVD has the same images in color, and therefore those can be consulted over there.
Exactly. Perhaps we could go through the four parts of the book. Part one, the history of excavation. Part two, the artifacts. Part three, the local and regional setting. Part four, the cultural heritage management. Starting off with the history of the excavation, here there are two articles. Unfortunately, we won't have time to talk a lot about them. However, I found them both really a wonderful introduction to the site. and you really got a feel of the history of the excavation. I think it's so much part of the narrative.
As you said, the book is divided into four parts, and the four parts you mentioned we thought would be a logical way of organizing all that we had to say about the site and its context. And in the first two chapters, which see me involved and Dr. Anton Bujeya, who is a medical doctor by profession but has a keen interest in antiquarianism, and also Marie-Elena Zamit from the National Museum of Archaeology, we thought it would be good to look at the history of the interest, antiquarian first and archaeological later, of the site. And it is incredible how Bujeya manages to show that the site of Borchen Nadur was on the fixed itinerary of grand tourists. And the reason for this was because in the course of the 17th and 18th centuries, antiquarians believed that the site of Borchen Nadur, which is where the prehistoric temple could be, the temple of Hercules, which is given coordinates in Ptolemy's geography of the first century AD. Now, unfortunately, we know that antiquarians got it wrong, that prehistoric remains at Borchen Nadur have got nothing to do with Ptolemy's Temple of Hercules, but this is not important. This is what the antiquarians believed at the time, and it was a logical way to make sense of archaeological remains as well. We will not go into the details because that can be a program in its own right, but just because it was on the tourist itinerary, there was a lot of interest. For example, one of the most interesting discoveries made by Bujeya, on a hint that was given to him by a friend of his from Gozo, Mr. Joao Tartabone, is that in the Hermitage in St. Petersburg, there was a drawing, which we placed on the front cover of the book, of remains drawn by Jean Houel in the late 18th century, which in fact show the prehistoric village of Borchen Nadur, not the temple, but the village, which is only about 200 meters away. It was always thought that that picture showed remains in Gozo, because that is how it is archived. It has always been archived at the museum in St. Petersburg, and we always thought that it was the Brokhtov Circle in Gozo. It's actually not. It is Borchen Nadur. In another chapter, we look at the history of excavations, and that is mostly the excavations carried out by Margaret Murray, who became a famous Egyptologist based at University College London.
At what period?
These are the 1920s, and excavations that took place later by David Trump, who was curator at the Museum of Archaeology in the late 50s and early 60s, and these excavations were in fact carried out in 1958, and we considered the results of those excavations.
Going on to part two, artifacts from the megalithic temple of Borchen Nadur. I mean, there are one, two, three, four articles, four chapters actually, on dedicated to this this subject. Is there a very large amount of pottery?
Yes, there was a large amount of pottery. My colleague Davide, who wrote up the chapter on the prehistoric pottery, did not think that there would be so much pottery, just because the person who had catalogued the material before did not give a number to every single piece of pottery. And instead, in one bag with one number, there might have been 20, 30, 40 or 50 sherds. So he started off with an estimate of how much it would cost him in time and money to do the exercise, and in fact he catalogued a lot more. Maxine Anastati considered the pottery, which is post-prehistoric in date, and that means classical. Clive Vella, who is a former student of ours, who is doing doctoral research at Brown University in the US, looked at the lithics, and there were many lithic artifacts, lithic tools, found at the site. And Carlo Veca, a young student at the University of Catania, considered what we call the small finds. In other words, those finds which are not made of clay, ceramics or lithics. In essence, we tried to bring to the attention of the scholarly and the general public in general all the material. We tried to be as comprehensive as possible. All the material that was discovered during the excavations. We tried to be as exhaustive as possible, because this material, in most cases, had never been published properly.
Sounds like a mammoth task. So part three, the site in its local and regional setting, this looking at Bourg-en-Ladour in relation to other sites which are nearby, which you've mentioned briefly before, and also looking at it in its Mediterranean context.
Yes, we have three chapters make up this part. The first one by Dr. Ruben Grima and Joanne Malia considered the what they call the life history of Bourg-en-Ladour and of another site in the area in Marsa-Schlock, Tas Silj. And they try to understand why the two sites are located where they are. Archaeological sites are not in a place just for the fun of it. There will be a reason why they are located there. And it's interesting that Bourg-en-Ladour, and especially the Roman villa in its immediate hinterland, is located where it is because it has a fantastic connection to a vast hinterland. And the hinterland of Bourg-en-Ladour is, in fact, the area of Asha and the present-day airport. And it is very likely that agricultural produce from there was channeled to the Roman villa site of Takacatura and eventually for export from the site, from the port down below. Tas Silj is not the site of a Roman villa, but is the site of a place for prayer. It is a temple. In fact, the Roman villa site in the area is not located at Tas Silj, but it is located further away at Zeytun. And it is located there because Zeytun is the perfect point to have connections with a number of ports. St. Thomas Bay, Marsa Scala, and also Marsa Schlock. So the function of the site is understood by the degree of connectivity that you have with the surrounding landscape. In another chapter, which I co-authored with David and Maxine Anastasi, we tried to consider now the site of Bourg-en-Ladour, and especially the Bronze Age remains over there, including those of the village, with the rest of the world. Malta was not cut off in the Bronze Age, but was in touch, certainly, with Southeast Sicily, and probably through the Southeast Sicilian bridgehead, was in touch also with an outside world. An outside world at the time meant mostly the Aegean. And by Aegean, I mean the Mycenaeans. It was probably, as David Atanasi shows in the third chapter of this part, there might have been resident Maltese in sites in southeast Sicily, because the pottery that we find in a number of sites in southeast Sicily is either a Maltese import or mimics a Maltese style of pottery. We are not certain because scientific analyses will have to be done on the pottery to ascertain where the pottery comes from. In other words, what type of pottery fabric the pottery consists of.
I think part four, we could have another program about actually managing the site and its landscape. Certainly there are some very interesting and sort of unusual discussions here, like the virtual reconstruction of Bourg-en-Ladour megalithic temple, for example. And I think that's...
Yes, the idea was to try and put, again, the emphasis of the site in its landscape. This is becoming more and more interesting, even for management purposes. Sites are no longer considered as dots on a map, unless that dot takes into consideration what is happening in the immediate surroundings. And in fact, in one chapter in part four of the book by Ruben Grima, a lot of attention is given to the history of how the site has been managed. And it is really a history of colonial attitudes towards archaeological sites, toward the native peasants who would have lived in the area, and the reaction of locals and also of colonial administrators here to the wishes of the crown, essentially. One chapter by Sharon Sultana looks at how the Bronze Age remains have been presented to the public at the National Museum of Archaeology.
I recommend everybody
Absolutely, because the display was inaugurated very recently, and there is a lot of new material on display which has just been conserved. And of course, once you go and see the material, you will want to go and see the archaeological sites. So I think the good thing about the book is the fact that we now have a need to try and do something at Borçin Nadur to preserve the site in its landscape context. As I said, in just over a square kilometer, there is so much history, starting from Ardalan to even the church on the foreshore, dedicated to St. George, which Abella tells us used to be the place where Mass was said before the galleys of the Knights of the Order would leave for missions overseas. So every spot there has a story to tell, and it would be an ideal way to create some sort of heritage park with a heritage trail. As you know, we have been there with members of the Archaeological Society in the past, and it's an amazing walk, and you can actually see so much in a small area, which I think is desperate for a bit of attention.
Just a word about the DVD, because those who manage to buy the book will get this DVD, and certainly they'll be able to see the photographs in very high res, and that's a pleasure. And they'll have another surprise as well. They'll have a bit of music.
Yes, they will have a bit of music, because the virtual reconstruction, which is a 10-minute DVD of the temple site of Borçin Nadur and its context, has a music score by the well-known Maltese musician Renzo Spiteri, who has also recently launched a DVD, a CD of music which was recorded in prehistoric sites in Malta. I remember Davide telling me we need a music score now, and I said, the best person to contact would be Renzo Spiteri. He is the man for the job, and at a ridiculous fee, because we were running out of money by this time, he gladly did this for us, and we are extremely grateful.
Well, that's wonderful. But in 2 seconds, you can tell us where the book will be available.
The book will be available from local bookshops shortly, hopefully. The book is also available for free download if you log into the site, www.polymetrica.com, the publisher's website. You can register, and the book can be downloaded for free. We paid a special license to allow this sort of thing to be available, especially to students. But I know that many Maltese readers would like to have the hard copy in hand, and hopefully that will be available soon.
I downloaded it myself, but I'm very much looking forward to having the hard copy. And obviously, if you get the hard copy, you get the DVD as well. Thank you very, very much, Dr. Nicholas Vellati, for coming today to talk to us about this book, Site, Artifacts and Landscape, Prehistoric Borçin Nadur, Malta. Thank you.
Thank you for being with us on University Matters. You can listen to any of the previous interviews in this series on the Campus FM website. I hope you'll join us again next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.
Il program li għadkom kem smajtu kien miġjub li l-kom biex xewqat tajba ta' Farsons Foundation.